questions and answers. So all that we'll ask is that you introduce yourself before you ask your question. Tell us who you are and where you are physically, I guess, at BC, what program you're in, and we'll go from there. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Yael. I'm a graduate student at the Political Science Department and the research assistant here at the Philosophy Center. Can you just say something as to why Kant or Habermas or any of the thinkers mentioned, I suppose, should be authorities for this topic, why we should look to them for guidance?
I mean, that's a very big question. Certainly you can just sort of like refer to all the literature about debates between sort of Kantians and Humeans and Aristotelians, and it partly depends on which views about morality, politics, or normative thinking more generally is the most plausible one. I mean, I basically think about this probably more from the direction of social theory rather than moral or political theory in a certain respect, because that's a certain aspect of me, my sort of Habermasianism. I think that it turns out that a broadly Kantian view of practical reasoning, of how human beings reason about action, is the only one that is likely to be able to account for identifiable features of human social interaction. So, for instance, if you take a Hobbesian or a Humean picture of practical reasoning, according to which ultimately rationality is instrumental rationality, identifying causal connections between a certain action and a certain outcome, and then allowing one's desires, which themselves are not cognitive, they're just given. You have a certain desire to achieve a certain kind of end. And through your cognitive awareness of the causal connections between various available actions and the outcomes that will be the causal effects of those actions, you select whichever one is the means to your end. But there's no, in a sense, there's no real reasoning about ends and about which ends you should have. And on that model, reasons for action always have to wind up being rooted in one's desires, one's sort of ends that one might have, goals that one might have. And there's no independent place for norms that simply say, you can't do this kind of thing, you can do this kind of thing. And the project then is always to figure out a way to reproduce that element of social life that we obviously have norms and rules, you know, that just say you're prohibited from doing this, you're permitted to do that, on the basis of desire. So that's the sort of foundationalist story that tries to go in terms of individual interests. And game theory for a very long time was carrying out this kind of Hobbesian Humean project. And I think that it just turns out that it doesn't work. One of the things that you can't reproduce with models of instrumental rationality is language use. So it just turns out that strategically acting agents who are only deciding what they want to do on the basis of whether they think it will allow them to achieve their own goals, and in situations in which that partly depends on what choices other agents will make, so they have to try and then figure out what the other agent is going to do in order to determine what's rational for them to do, and the other agent also has to do that. And there are all kinds of problems with this model where you get a sort of regress of I can't decide what I should do until I know what you should do, you can't decide what you should do until you know what I'm going to do, and you can generate some indeterminacy that way. But it also turns out that they could never converge on a shared understanding of what a noise that they're uttering to each other means. So they get what they call babbling equilibria. So if you have a model of action that can't explain language use, it's a pretty bad model of action. But I think that turns out to be related to the notion that rule following is an intrinsic foundational part of human reasoning and action. So that basic Kantian model, I think, is right. So that gets rid of sort of the Humeans. I think it's also problematic for old Aristotelian models. I'm just sort of doing process of elimination through the sort of major alternatives in Western political theory. But I think Aristotle has similar problems, and he sort of contorts himself into odd positions when he tries to talk about justice and certain kinds of actions that there really isn't like an intermediate between, you know, extremes, but you just can't do them. They're inherently wrong, like committing adultery or something like that. And I think it's partly related to that, that they hadn't really figured out a way to get this element of... So it's a kind of technical thing. I could give you references if you want. But that's broadly why I think the Kantian position is right. However, I'll give the foundationless picture to people who want it. And in a way, that's sort of the one aspect of trying to say, here's why it's authoritative. Because there's this duty you have to respect humanity in yourself. I'm more sympathetic, in a way, to the non-foundationless view. But the foundationless view is more dominant, so I have to offer that story to my interlocutors in the debate. And the other view is more like, because when we have, in situations in which lots and lots of people have been able to try and hash these things out socially through all kinds of processes of struggle, contestation, and argument, there are certain things that seem to have survived as things that are mutually justifiable, publicly justifiable, some sort of human rights standards, you know. And those have survived this sort of ongoing critical scrutiny. So it's not the authority of this or that philosopher, it's more an authority of sort of a collective social practice, similar to the authority of science. So if you ask me, why should we accept the authority of science? I mean, in a way, there's too much to say, in a way, there's not much to say.
Let's bring in another question.
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, okay, yes, Frank.
Hey, Frank Garcia from the law school. Jonathan, what kinds of political obligations flow from this at the world society level? Do you admit of different levels of obligation for national units or beyond?
Yeah, it's kind of, I'm still sort of working out some of the details, but I also have a somewhat modest view about what philosophers can do in terms of telling other people what their specific moral duties are. So in a certain sense, it's an attempt to offer more of a general framework in which individuals can, in a very under-institutionalized context, what they can use to reason about what they think their responsibilities might be. And so when Jung offers these different parameters, there are different ways of understanding one's position in some of these broad processes. In each individual case, on the basis of one's position, one has to try and think about what one's responsibilities might be. I do think that, in general, if you think about that issue about there needing to be some institutionalization of compulsory adjudication and enforcement of at least some central range of rights at the global level, broadly speaking, every actor in the world society has a standing duty to at least not hinder, perhaps if they're in a position to promote, a certain kind of movement towards that goal. And I'm very, very flexible about the time window that we're talking about here. It could be centuries. I'm not super gung-ho about like some kind of immediate attempt to sort of institutionalize, you know, global democracy or anything like that.
I'm curious. Oh, yeah, David.
I wonder if you'd flesh out...
Could you introduce yourself to the rest of the people?
...a bit about...
No.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dave Rasmussen.
Thank
you. I wonder if you'd flesh out a bit about the cosmopolitan argument. I mean, it's a lot of criticism of cosmopolitanism. The recent stuff on Kantian cosmopolitanism tends to make it a bit more empirical.
Mm-hmm.
You start with the argument from the metaphysics of morals, which I use as the civil condition, you know, that
mm-hmm.
section 8, which gives you the argument. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if it's just a rational argument, or if you think that Kant really has some empirical... Now, Habermas wants to sort of make it more empirical, of course, but if you think it really is somewhat empirical, even at the beginning.
I don't necessarily have clear views about how the relationship between the so-called pure a priori parts of Kant's practical philosophy relate to the obviously partly empirical claims about, say, the Earth being a sphere and so on. I think, though, it's clear that... I think this is actually one of the problems with the construction. So there is the empirical reference to the sort of empirical fact that we're embodied we have to occupy some space, the earth is a sphere, and so on. But it's obvious that, as I understand the notion of a world society, there were large parts of human history in which it would not make any sense at all to say there was any kind of world society. And Kant makes it very hard to really understand the significance of the actual progression of social and political changes that led to where we are, because this highly stylized state of nature argument, and for him it's totally sort of hypothetical, it's just purely sort of explanatory, and just like in the moral sense or justification of political authority. But I think that's a little odd if it turns out to be the case that, in effect, there in every social order there are ways of fulfilling certain kinds of functions, like providing collectively binding decisions for the social group, and securing shared behavioral expectations for the members of the social group. And those are the key functions that some social theorists identify as being nowadays the special task of the political system, collectively binding decisions, and the legal system, securing shared behavioral expectations. And if it's the case that every social group, you know, all of human history has consisted of some kind of, in that sense, political authority, the need to sort of provide this kind of state of nature, no society, no political authority, then, you know, political authority argument is much less drastic. And then you have to tell some other story about why this particular story about what we're obligated to do is authoritative. And it's a much more difficult story to tell. Kant can do it, in, even though he was approaching senility, you know, in like 20 pages or so. So that's my sense, is, yeah, more empirical. Kant, I think, was already referring to empirical stuff, like at the end when he makes that claim in the perpetual peace thing. That's obviously more commercial interactions. There's colonialism, imperialism, that have causally drawn together peoples in different parts of the earth. So I think there's probably a lot more empirical stuff in Kant than maybe even Kant wanted to admit.
We have time for one last question, I think. People are up for it. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Paul Van Roy from the philosophy department. I'm hoping you can give a little bit more detail maybe for thinking that this concept of social responsibility is really distinct from the kind of normal moral liability kind of responsibility. And if so, you know, granting that, what kinds of obligations do you think are connected to it? And is this something that sort of comes out of the process of social evolution, so that, you know, it doesn't seem quite plausible to say that these kinds of responsibilities would pertain to people in, say, tribal societies, you know, thousands of years ago or something. So at some point in time, it seems much more plausible to say, you know, I have a responsibility to care for what happens to the you know, exploited laborers, you know, 5,000 miles away or whatever. But, you know, maybe if you could give a bit more detail about that concept, I think it might be helpful.
So let's just stick with, like, you know, the example of sort of sweatshops, maybe, you know, my shirt being made in Bangladesh. I mean, it's obviously partly sort of an empirical contingent matter, what particular morally relevant, or I don't set much store by the moral political distinction. I actually, what I don't like about this sort of foundationist way, I think it puts a lot of weight on this sort of moral political distinction. So I'll just say normative, like, it's a normative reflection about one's responsibilities, responsibilities which are triggered, so to speak, because of one's participation in some of these social processes that foreseeably and avoidably lead to domination, deprivation, mistreatment, and so on. It's because we don't have institutional mechanisms that exist to try and specify what the obligations of people are, like we do with respect to, say, when people in the United States are unemployed, we have a whole set of laws and institutions that specify how much unemployment insurance they get per month, what the conditions are under which you're eligible for that insurance. And we all have obligations to support that, we just don't think about it much because we just pay our taxes. So the institutions take care of a kind of social, moral division of labor. With a lot of these kinds of processes, there is no such institution. The liability model tends to, again, also, you know, when there are institutions, go by way of like civil law, you know, tort law, criminal law, something like that. So like with respect to this shirt, suppose this shirt was made at the Rana Plaza building. I mean, the way the institution exists now, it's not like a group of workers in Bangladesh, I presume, can somehow figure out a way to haul me into court and try and determine what my specific legal liability is for damages that they have suffered. So that's part of the distinction between liability and responsibility. Nevertheless, there's some sense in which I am causally implicated, as well as, you know, this kind of historical, you know, implication, and to some extent perhaps also, you know, the rules that govern the global economy, insofar as I'm a member of the global economy, I'm implicated in what's going on there, and I support it, you know, through my consumption decisions, even though, as we talked about, so I had a conversation with Paul, well, maybe could you avoid this by just going to Goodwill, and then he told me, which I was horrified to learn, that Goodwill dumps a lot of shirts on the continent of Africa, and that has negative economic effects on people in Africa who otherwise might have been able to make a living by selling shirts. So there's really, I think in the world as it is today, there's no way of avoiding a lot of responsibility for a lot of different things. So many, with respect to issues of such complexity that they completely overtax the ability of individuals to figure out. And because of that, you have to allow a lot of discretion and a lot of contingent factors. So I mentioned to Eric in a conversation we had before the talk that for me, I'm married into a Mexican-American family. I happen to speak Spanish tolerably well. I have friends in Chile and so on. And so for that reason, over time, gradually, issues with respect to U.S.-Mexico, U.S.-Latin America relations have become much more salient. And I think, in a way, morally speaking, it's totally contingent with respect to my obligations qua U.S. citizen. But on the other hand, I think it's legitimate for individuals to exercise discretion to commit themselves to trying to, so to speak, you know, to sort of get into like the platitudes or whatever, make the world a better place. How they're going to try and do that with whatever limited time and resources they have in order to do that. Again, that's the issue of the modest role that I think philosophers have in determining what people's specific obligations are. But I think you could say in general there's a kind of responsibility. But it's open-ended in a certain sense.
Well, maybe there's hope if we don't have to figure it all out individually. There's hope for us yet, right? Thank you all. Thank you, Jonathan, for being here. We really appreciate it.